Welcome to Scenes, conversations in culture with the people who know it best. We chat with guests across music, art, fashion, film, sport, and technology in a bid to understand the scenes we love that little bit better. I'm your host, Kosti Kontaravdis, and today, Ruby and I chat all things chess with a highly regarded professional chess coach. We chat cheating scandals to questionable sponsorship deals to the pros and cons of online gaming. We pry into the stereotypes that surround both players and the sport. We look into everything from gimmicks to gameplay to the Queen's Gambit and so much more. So without further ado, this is The Chess Scene, brought to you by Truant London. Today in the Scene studio, we're blessed to be joined by Phil Makepeace, my friend, for once. Phil is a highly regarded professional chess coach with over two decades of experience in the sport. Having competed in his first chess tournament at the tender age of six, he's gone on to represent England junior squad in Lithuania, Czech Republic, Poland, USA and Ireland, as well as captain the 2007 under-18s England team to victory in the Glorney Cup.
That's correct.
Did I say that right?
You did.
Now coaching and consulting in schools, chess clubs, and Hollywood films like Morbius, alongside his podcast called The Chess Pit. It's an amazing podcast. Definitely go listen to it. And you can find that on all podcasting platforms. And I'm really hyped to get stuck into this scene with the legend that is Phil Makepeace.
Woo!
And we'll add audio sound effects of people
clapping. Woo, woo, woo. Yeah. Can laughter.
Absolutely. Phil, we're starting this with a new question. We don't normally ask this. What the hell is chess?
Chess. Oh, it's everything.
Oh, wow.
Chess is the battle of both mind and nerve.
Yeah.
And how the reason I really love it is because it can be played between two people of any age, gender, religion, background, anything. It is the big equalizer in life. Wow. And it's designed as an allegory for war. But that doesn't mean that we have to have, you know, fisticuffs. We can just have a nice little kind of battle if we play. And at the end of it, the nice thing is that everything just goes back to where it was. The starting position goes back. So even if you mess up, you just get another shot next time. And I think that's... I'm a big believer in second and third and fourth and fifth chances. It's as an allegory for life, not necessarily for war, I think is what I'd put it as.
That's a lovely viewpoint, and I think that's wonderful. Unlike in war,
unlike in
real fighting,
yes, exactly.
You might only have one chance. That's lovely, and I guess that kind of leads into this next one. You have a great viewpoint of it now, and clearly your understanding of it and the way in which you value it is very inspiring. But what was the first thing that really made you want to kind of start playing? Especially because if you've been competing at the age of six, I imagine you had to start even younger than that. And what drove you into chess?
So the 1993 World Championship was played between Garry Kasparov and Nigel Short. Nigel Short, English bloke.
Yeah.
And it was on Channel 4. It was broadcast on Channel 4. It was hosted by Carol Vorderman and a guy called Daniel King, who's an English chess grandmaster.
Yeah.
And my dad, I was age four, and my dad was like watching it in the evening. And apparently I toddled over and just took an organic interest.
No way.
Whether or not my dad was watching it because he liked chess or because he liked Carol Vorderman, not sure. Don't know. But my parents were like, okay, let's see how he does.
Yeah.
And that was the nice thing about my parents' influence, or that they taught me the moves. But then, not being chess players themselves, they then did the sensible thing and let other people take over my learning process. But they were nothing but supportive ever by taking me to tournaments and things and introducing me to tournament play in both locally, where I grew up in Buckinghamshire, and eventually nationally. And the first tournament I played when I was six in, I think it was April 1996,
wow.
I won. And then that qualified me for the National Under Sevens. I came second in that. And so in kind of like being driven wasn't really a thing where I was pushed particularly. Mm-hmm. It was just something I did. and then happen to be okay at. And yeah. then from there, if you're doing well in a tournament, then you might play another one and you might do well in that. I had other things. I was, you know, I played football and cricket and I ran and I did badminton, and chess was never like the be all and end all. And I think that's something that, again, I appreciate my parents not necessarily pushing me too hard.
Yeah, for sure.
Because, you know, I've had other things in my life. I'm now a professional coach and chess is my life again, but that's okay. It's not, I don't think I would be a professional coach and have chess as my thing. If I'd been pushed too hard as a kid, I'd probably just want to do something else completely, and maybe I'd be completely separated from the sport. So yeah, in terms of that, it just kind of happened. And it was a big happenstance that I happened to be four or five when it was on TV for pretty much the only time in the UK since then. It hasn't really happened since. There hasn't been anything on UK TV for about 30 years.
And do you think that's probably because as well, you know, like, did the English Grandmaster win that game?
He lost the match heavily.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And so that definitely is the thing. Like, he's the only ever English world champion challenger in the modern era, so since the late Victorian era. And so therefore, yeah, there's definitely a consequence of that where chess isn't going to have its publicity provided automatically, because the match happened at the Savoy Theatre down the road as well.
Oh, nice.
So it was local as well, so it was, you know, an English challenger playing in England against Garry Kasparov, who had been world champion at that point for 8 years and would go on to be world champion for another seven. You know, the legend of his era.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, Nigel Short was a household name, and chess for a bit became a thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But there was no momentum, possibly, as you say, because he lost the match heavily.
Yeah, fair enough. But I mean, it's nice to, with all of these instances, when you have someone from your own national country that is up on this stage and, you know, is televised, that does have a huge influence. Whenever, like, especially in competitive sports, I remember when England won the Rugby World Cup and Johnny Wilkinson scored that amazing drop kick right at the sort of last minute. And though it's such a bit of a foggy memory, I do recall like the rugby frenzy that occurred afterwards. And I imagine it was a similar thing, like right place at the right time. You're young, you're already kind of there watching this sort of spectacle on screen. And now there's a bit of a buzz around the thing that you're mildly interested in.
Yeah, it's the who's watching it, who's watching those those shows, who's watching the coverage. It's going to be people of above a certain age, and then it's who they then go on to inspire. And we've seen that a lot with, well, I'm sure we'll get onto the Queen's Gambit, but that's what's happened with that, where it's not a child-friendly show.
Yeah.
It's young adults, parents, older, watching this Netflix phenomenon and then passing it on. Mm-hmm. That's what's happened. And that's what happened. It's not, you know, I'm sure that, as you say, with the Rugby World Cup, and I've seen it, I was a cricket broadcaster for a few years as well in the 2010s. And I was there when England women won the World Cup in 2017 at Lord's. And the number of young women and girls who went on to play because of that.
Yeah.
That's definitely a thing. But sport, I think, is more... sport, like physical sport, it's much easier to have that organic thing where a child can watch something on TV or go to a game. Chess, not quite so much, because it's, if you don't know the rules, it's just, it's like the Matrix. You're not going to understand what's going on there. So it needs to be passed on. It needs that extra layer of knowledge and development for someone to take a, it doesn't have to be a kid, you know. You see, the current boom is a lot of young adults who've watched the Queen's Gambit, for example, being guided along by their mates. That's the thing about chess, that it looks difficult, but that's only because it's not automatically, you can I guess learn a bit by just looking, but you do probably need that extra layer of guidance that you may not get from just watching a cricket game and seeing someone, or rugby and seeing someone run with the ball across the line. It's a different type of vibe with regards to the development and how you get people into it.
And I think it is a technical sport in that respect, right? And it is something, and we'll go into talking about what the, I guess, its association with intelligence and maybe the type of cultural class it stereotypically considered in. But just to go quickly back to where young Phil was, to be that young and to be competing, were you truly like one of the youngest people around, or is it still filled even now tournaments with like people as young as six?
Yeah, I mean, largely have separate junior and adult tournaments. The best juniors will play with adults in what are called grading limited sections. So right. It's not just like one big open where you throw in the 6 year olds against the grandmasters. You will have, you get a rating by playing games. And then if you are under a certain rating, you can participate in these grading limited tournaments, and they'll go all the way down to sort of lowest strata. So that is definitely a thing that means that, that's what I was saying earlier, it's the great equalizer. You can have young kids playing at the same level as a 70-year-old because that's just where they're at, and it's not segregated that way. And in terms of what I did, I don't think I really played against adults properly until I was 9 or 10. That again, I think, came from my parents not necessarily seeing it as a sort of a means to an end, like in terms of having particular ambitions for me. What they liked about chess as well, if I'm playing in a junior tournament, you're playing against kids your own age, you make friends, you have fun, you go away for a weekend to, I mean, the venues weren't necessarily so salubrious, like Torquay and Stoke-on-Trent, places like this, Scarborough, Scarbados,
nice.
But that's the nice thing about the junior events is that, yeah, you are just making friends, and some of my best friends still are kids I met at these events when I was small, and my parents are still friends with their parents. And it's no different from anything else in that respect. You know, you get, where's it, the soccer moms and that kind of vibe.
I love that. The chess moms scene. That's the next episode.
Yeah.
You're going to get your mum on the app. As a scene in chess, you don't resent your opponent in the same way as perhaps other sports. You don't have rivalries maybe in the same way.
I disagree. I think there's big rivalries.
Right.
Yeah. Ooh. Not necessarily at the amateur level, but certainly because of the longevity of it, as you say, and just the wax and the wane of interpersonal relationships. You could, you know, there's people that, I don't think I've ever particularly had a rival with anyone, but I could name others within British chess, certainly at the top level, where these were probably contemporaries at age 10 who were maybe the top two for their age in the country. And then that maybe helped them to a point because they could bring each other up.
Yeah.
And then maybe as their personality changed and they just, you know, you just get this thing. But, you know, there's players who are still in the top 10, 15 in the country who are in their mid-60s who were probably amazing friends 40 years ago and maybe don't speak to each other anymore. Mm. That's fine.
When you play now, or when you're coaching, you start to recognize the difference between like people who do it for fun or people who do want to actually succeed as a competitor in this sport.
I think there's no particular difference, and there doesn't really need to be, because I think it's something you can do casually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But the point is that chess, unlike other sports, has, it's quite hard to play badly if you're, as in like below yourself.
Right.
So you're always going to find someone of your own level.
Yeah.
And if that's what competition means to you, then that's great. I mean, I think there are people who will behave differently if they are trying to attain a certain level. But in terms of the actual playing, I think it's not that easy to spot. You know, it's just because someone's talking and laughing during a game in the pub or whatever, doesn't mean they're taking it less seriously than someone who's there, you know, with a chess book, maybe the board by themselves. Yeah. It's a vehicle for creativity. It's a vehicle for socialization and that one-to-one battle. And that doesn't mean that you're taking it any less seriously than anyone else. In terms of, your question, can I tell? I mean, if someone is very intense, then maybe.
Yeah.
But just looking generally, that's what I like about chess as well, is that because of that, that's why the more social elements of it, these like pop-up pub events, or, well, they've got at the moment on the South Bank, they've just got
random boards out.
And this new government initiative to provide more of those, where it's just a granite table with a sort of chessboard imprinted into them. That's going to just increase the visibility of chess being a fun thing,
a fun
that thing. Anyone can do.
Yeah, I'm kind of interested about that. So like with chess popping up in a bit more of like, I want to say like social environments, so like in at pubs or like by the South Bank, like beyond it being like a professional thing, do you think this has really helped with it, as you were just saying, like become kind of just like a really lovely like hobby or passion for people just to pick up and chat with friends while they're doing it, and it just be more of like a thing to do in a social context and meet people? And yeah
just normalize it, right?
Normalizing it, yeah.
I've done
kind
less...
of makes it feel a bit less like this elite like mind sport, which it is, but it also is something that you can do.
It doesn't have to be. That's the thing. It's just a mind sport.
Mm-hmm.
It's not any more or less involving than say poker or backgammon in terms of the effort involved. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's a depth to the game that's different,
for sure.
But that doesn't mean that it's not accessible to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the people who play chess, because actually, like, there was obviously lots of different levels, lots of different ages. As a stereotype, especially in the West, as something that is associated with this higher sense of intelligence, possibly a higher sense of like social status as well. How much truth is there in that now in 2023?
I'm not convinced about the social status, but maybe, I guess you're right that insofar as a lot of like maybe detective novels, there's always the...
Well, you're playing with royalty on the table. There's like kings and queens. There's like, maybe it's more of a, not a social status, but the association of the game is like, okay, you know, it's a proper sport.
Yeah, if you equate intelligence or a certain type of thinking with social status, then that would probably qualify. But I think that the type of people who play, I mean, there's all sorts. I mean, yeah, you get, yes, people with very triple-barreled names and lots of letters after them, and who are in the higher echelons. But then you get someone who's maybe never really had any kind of other standing in life. Maybe they didn't do so well at school. Maybe they haven't been so well, and they can still play. I mean, the one I go back to is there's a bloke called John Healy, who was an Irish tramp, effectively, living in London, who, during his time in prison for vagrancy in the 60s, became very good at chess and was, when he came out, was one of the leading amateurs in London. Let's say that. He's probably about, maybe slightly below or about my level.
And what's vagrancy?
Yeah, being homeless.
Oh, just being homeless.
It was just... it was a criminal offence in the 50s and 60s. So
fair enough.
Yeah, he would be your kind of maybe exception that proves that maybe the rule doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, the stereotype's a weird one, and I think it's mostly because, and definitely a Western thing, maybe like because in films it was, you know, the kids at school who stayed in the little quiet space with the glasses just sat there playing this quiet game versus the ones who are more confident and extroverted and were eccentric who wouldn't play.
Yeah.
But would you have like these eccentric rock stars in chess as well?
Yeah. There's a few players.
Zany
who...
bunch. Zany folk.
There's a few top of the top players who you could very easily see modelling. You know,
right.
Just these blokes with long hair and... kind of Adrian Brody-esque features. There's a guy called, there's a couple of spring to mind, Sasha Grischuk, Baja Zhivava. These are thought of as cool players as well. Mm. Just in terms of, you see them during their interviews, they just don't really care. They're just cool. This was a thing. And they're not arrogant. They're just
rock and roll.
They just have no time for these. Yeah, they just have no time for this nonsense. One thing you get in wider culture that involves chess is these frankly evil people, evil characters
that evil mastermind villain.
Yeah.
And that is absolutely true.
Really? I love that. That's where we add in the canned laughter.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about just different cultures within chess, because yes, in the UK, in the US, we may use it as this vehicle to talk about intellect and the people at school who choose chess over like physical sports are just a fast pass to saying that they were the smart, nerdy kids versus the strong, muscly kids or the popular kids. And it's always just been that like polarizing disparity. But I want to know about the influence that the East has, especially when these names like Kasparov and the two you mentioned a moment ago. Like, what's the culture of what you know coming from the Eastern Europe side?
So one thing that I think is important, and the people, we've probably just done it in here, and people listening will have done this as well. When you mention that kind of stereotypical, the nerdy kid, the one who's not the sporty type, probably thinking of a boy, aren't you?
Yeah, for sure.
And that's something that I think the Eastern European influence on chess has massively made it, it's popularized it among girls and women, because in Russian schools, and it's not just Russia, but maybe some of the former Soviet blocs, so Armenia for sure, Uzbekistan at the moment has a big influence. School chess is on the school curriculum and it's offered to everyone. And what you have in that scene is a far narrower ratio of boys v girls, men v women playing, which inevitably just broadens the space and broadens the scene in that way. So when I've been to other Eastern Bloc, former Eastern Bloc countries, like you mentioned at the beginning, Lithuania, particularly, just an enormous number of girls playing there compared to in this country. My chess clubs, it's roughly 60-40, but that's below age 11.
Right.
After, once girls get into secondary school, there seems to be a thing where it's not that they're not interested anymore, it's that the infrastructure doesn't necessarily exist beyond that in whatever the culture is for them to have the correct opportunities to develop. Like there are just simply more chess clubs in boys' secondary schools if it's a single sex school than there are in girls. Mm. I have tried to start clubs in two girls' secondary schools in the last year and just can't get the numbers. So you got to try.
Yeah, of course.
But what you have with the Eastern Europeans, particularly, a lot of world champions.
Yeah.
Therefore, it's not just boys who are being inspired, but girls and women as well. And so you have this much more broader reflection of the population in countries where there is a proper infrastructure, like in Russia, like in India, in the USA.
Right.
Whereas Western Europe struggles a bit for lots of reasons, some financial in terms of the amount of money, the resources that's being put into the game on a grassroots level, but also in just, that thing where we are almost told in the wider media that chess is a boys' game.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's unhelpful.
It is unhelpful. And I think it's also a wonderful segue into a very famous show where a woman played chess. And it wouldn't be a culture podcast if we didn't talk about, say it with me,
The Queen's Gambit.
So we've got a little stat about The Queen's Gambit. Mm. After its release in October 2020, 12.2 million players joined online playing on sites like chess.com, and the sale of chess boards increased by 400%. Have you noticed in any other way how this show has changed the world of chess?
Yes. So earlier I said about how it's about passing it on. So you've got the parents and grandparents who've watched this show and taught their young kids. What you have a lot of it now is young adults who've watched it and are now playing. And there's one chess club in Tooting, particularly, that I sometimes go to on a Thursday evening. It's just in a pub, and they get 40, 50 people a night. More than half are women.
Mm. Wow.
Fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's all it needs. All it needs is just that, as it's exactly the same thing. The normalization of anything within a particular space. If that's women playing chess in a pub, fantastic. If that's what it needs to be, brilliant. And that's what I've noticed, particularly in tournaments. I've played another tournament in April, my first kind of like local tournament for a bit. Loads of women between the ages of 20 and 30 in the sections. And it was really, really good to see. Just, you can just, having been in that space for, nearly 30 years.
Yeah.
it was just visibly different. And there's the phenomenon of, yeah, in public spaces, women's toilets, always a queue.
Yeah.
Chess tournament, nah.
No. Yeah,
it used to be not a thing.
Now you'd
actually see a queue outside the women's toilet.
Right, which is a great thing in this context.
Yeah.
It's a great thing.
Horrible if you've got to use the loo.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the thing I've mainly noticed is, and also the thing is, it's not necessarily something that the World Federation has particularly helped. They are, if you think that like FIFA or FINA or other sporting bodies are bad, FIDE, which is the World Chess Federation, is just damaging to really? This.
They
are a horrible, horrible body that has people on their board who are proven sexists. And right. What's nice about what we're seeing is that it's coming from the bottom up. If the top down doesn't work, if there's not going to be enough support from the top, people have got to motivate themselves and organize themselves. And that's what we're seeing with the English Chess Federation is actually quite good at this. They've got a particularly active and encouraging women's director and director of girls chess as well, who are creating these spaces. Men and women and girls and boys should be playing together, of course.
That's
but
what
you
I was
still
gonna say.
Need
yeah.
the safe spaces aside of that when you yeah. have a minority in anything.
Yeah.
It's still very useful to have separation yeah. mm. for that growth and for that safety.
It's yeah. also really important because I feel like even looking beyond physical chess, kind of like with the stat about how many people joined chess.com, which should be a very wholesome website, like I feel like the women players on that get like ripped to shreds sometimes, and they're like on the Reddit threads and stuff. And
yeah,
I mean, that's kind of, we talked about this in the last episode about female gamers and looking at it in like a way of people playing virtual chess virtually. Yeah, gotta make it a little, I don't know, I hope that it filters into the online world as well.
Well, unfortunately, I think that,
I mean, that's just privy to monsters.
well, yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I think most people who are, you know, your keyboard warriors and, yeah. and your trolls are going to be male.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that's not going to change in anything, unfortunately. So
yeah.
that's something that is particularly why it's important to have these safe spaces so mm-hmm. that, you know, you've got this community of people who are going to be able to help themselves beyond what help is available and what community is available, you know, immediately.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, over time, you hope that, and with the rising interest, there will be more like regulation and more being done by some of these event organizers and by these sponsors to ensure that it feels like a safe space and a safe scene for people to kind of get involved in at any age and any sex and any gender.
Yeah, absolutely. You don't need to change the game. It's
yeah,
not the issue.
Sure.
The game isn't the issue. It's
yeah,
the space
yeah.
entirely. And so that's the, but what it can then do is go too far where you maybe, I mean, there was a separate women's world championship. I don't wish to deny the current crop of the best women in the world their professional job.
Yeah.
But equally, there's no real practical need for it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Especially if you're a girl who's very, very good for their age, irrespective of gender. But you see that you're the number, maybe you're a 13-year-old girl who's the number 8 in the country.
Yeah.
That will already get you in the national team for the women's team. And you maybe don't push yourself as much to get in the overall thing because that's where the problem comes when you've got fewer women and girls playing. Inevitably, it's just a numbers game. You're going to have fewer at the top just by dint of numbers.
It's the same issue. I know as a Formula One fan, I see it being talked about a lot. You know, there's no reason why they cannot compete and work their way up. But when there's just a lot less of them and there's a lot less opportunities for them, there's a lot less role models for them. And I think even when you start looking at the Queen Gambit, though it was a fictional like hero's tale for this woman, for Beth, suddenly like you do recognize it and you see her success and you root for her. You root for her as this underdog beating these grandmasters who are much older than her and who are much more conservative perhaps than her. And yeah, it's those stories that we know work.
Yeah. the story of an opioid addict becoming an amazing chess player. Yeah. That's all that we need right now. It's all that we deserve, certainly.
Absolutely. So I'm also aware that we talked about chess.com before we really made the separation. And maybe, Phil, you could bless us with that luxury of just talking a little bit about the difference between like playing here physically and online.
It's completely different vibe. There's no substitute for sitting opposite someone and having that. It's that kind of that nervous tension of just, and the pride almost in a proper competitive game. Against you, I'm gonna leave that at the door.
Yeah.
Thank God. But the way that the online space is just is so much more anonymized.
Yeah.
A, it takes the pressure off, but B, leads to, as Ruby said, instances of abuse and just general kind of, you know, griefing, I believe it's called in the gaming sphere. And so I think the opportunities that come from having good, reliable, practical servers that offer, you know, you can finish your game and then immediately you can get a big computer analysis that will tell you where you went wrong and suggest improvements. But there is no, and you can get decent at that, decent by playing just online, but there is no substitute for that socialization. Yeah. And that's what it's really for. You know, you're not going to get the full chess picture in your life if you only play online. And there's lots of people who have become very good online and then have gone to play real tournaments and just can't replicate that. They because they've never played properly in person, that intensity isn't quite there. And because online chess is played a bit quicker maybe, and with a bit more frivolity, they all maybe just, that's one thing I can see you're saying about people who may be playing more seriously or less seriously earlier, and I said they can't really tell the difference. I can possibly, if you showed me 10 games, five of which were played by someone who'd played tournament chess for 20 years and someone who'd only just played online, I reckon I could tell the difference
in terms
of the way they play. Because it's a very different style that computers have as well. Right. And if you're only relying on advice from a computer after the game, rather than analysing it with your opponent or with a mate, you're going to get completely different suggestions than you are going. It's going to mould your play in a different way. So that's one thing that online chess does. It's created a new breed of player who plays in a very particularly exact way, but who doesn't necessarily understand why.
That leads quite nicely into the next thing we really wanted to talk about, and that's chess's rich history with computing. And we know of like these big stories that were happening throughout the 80s and 90s of like the grandmaster, number one chess ranked player in the world, competing against this series of computers. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, won the first game, lost the second game.
Something like that, yeah.
Something like that.
Deep Blue, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Kasparov.
Yes.
And in this moment, it really took, again, the whole world was watching. Mastermind, someone who we consider in culture as a genius, competing against a machine. It was like man versus machine. And even though it was, you know, humans who programmed this machine, that was the story. And oddly, that we're still talking about now the pros and cons of like online versus the physical. These machines, there must be more to it. Is the real debate here like challenging the integrity of the sport?
There have been numerous cheating scandals lately with people who have used machine assistants. I mean, when you were talking about Deep Blue there, that was nearly 30 years ago, and yeah, Kasparov still was able to compete. Now you've got on your phone or on your Apple Watch a better machine than, you know, any human could ever dream of.
Yeah.
So the portability of machines in chess has led to that, but the practicality of having that in your fingertips can't be a bad thing.
Yeah.
Chess has not been solved. Chess will never be solved, in my opinion. The computing power to deal with a game that where the number of possible moves is greater than the number of atoms in the universe.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that's going to be a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
with regards to the integrity of the game, yes, it damages it when you have a cheating scandal or when you have this idea that humans can never compete with a computer again. I'm not sure if that's so relevant. If computers are helping us to get better, and also, as I said, just creating a different type of chess.
Mm-hmm.
There's the best machine in the world is called AlphaZero, and it's a self-taught machine.
Oh right, yeah.
It's just like AI.
It's mad, and it's created by DeepMind, who are a branch of Google.
Yeah.
By a guy called Demis Hassabis, who is one of the leading AI experts in the world and a master chess player. And what that has done is show completely new possibilities in the game. It's not that chess had stagnated in terms of theory or principle. It's more just these computers are playing so differently that humans look at the games they played and go, what? Just nothing really that looks like a grandmaster game. And I don't see that changing anytime soon.
Yeah.
So I think in terms of the integrity of machine versus human, fine. I think it's just separate. I think they're just separate entities now. Computer chess that can help us understand maybe more, and human chess, which is just inevitably going to be played at such so much less exact and therefore more fun, I think.
Yeah.
Everything is more fun to watch. Yeah. People are making mistakes. For sure.
I think it's like the everlasting debate with man versus machine, which is like the coldness and like clinical feeling of machine, and chess is this sort of like very rich, it means like one of the oldest sports in the bloody world.
The oldest?
No, I think actually, isn't there one that's a bit old? Anyways, it's like very cold and very clinical, and it's an easy thing to kind of fear and like fear monger about a little bit, about like this idea of stripping the sociality and like this kind of human connection out of it. But I think you're right, and that is changing with chess.com. Obviously, if it's being played at like a mega professional level, perhaps it's a different conversation. But I think now it's being viewed less as this sort of man versus computer, will they outsmart the computer, but more as a tool to make people who want to learn it have a way to learn it, and it'd be pretty accessible.
Yeah, I mean, as a professional coach, I don't feel threatened
by
it, because what you don't get with the machines is the explanation, and you don't get the human side of it. And I'm a big fan of what I'd call the practical side of chess. Like, I could play a move that's very fun, that sacrifices a rook and does stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And the computer will shit all over it.
Yeah, yeah.
But then so what?
So what? Yeah. I think
it was still a fun and dramatic fun moment thing. For me.
It relied, the computer saying, your opponent can respond to this in this certain way. Maybe they don't.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a gamble.
I think, exactly. I feel like this kind of debate like translates into so many things. I mean, even in advertising, the whole idea of man versus machine has been so ingrained into human creativity, and whether you view it as something that'll replace it or take out something really important, or something that is a tool that can augment it to make your work a little bit better. And to help you learn skills. I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah.
It's about like extending what is possible, right? And when you were kind of playing chess, and I've seen videos of people playing and making like notation, very rarely did I think about the preparation that goes into the game itself and that dedication that a chess player might actually do, being something that you would naturally watch videos of this person, your competitor, who to try get, I guess, understand how they're going to play. Or it would make sense if you're making these moves that are all recorded, all calculated, to think about how you can use technology to give you new ideas. But fundamentally, it's still you playing it, right?
Correct.
It's still you in the moment with the pressure on, still feeling that excitement towards certain moves, still feeling that like sort of trying to like, bluff your way when you can see that there's like openings happening, but you don't want to seem too excited.
Yeah, there will always be room for human creativity, irrespective of what a machine tells you.
And is that something that you hear in the scene, people still talk about and romanticize and think of it as like something lovely? Or do people kind of romanticize cheating as well?
I don't think they romanticize cheating, but they certainly possibly have an over-reliance on engines, yeah, where they're saying, you know, oh, this is... You see it in the World Championship commentary as well. These World number two was commentating on the latest World Championship, and even he was relying on the end, what the engine was saying, and it just seemed really wrong that,
yeah,
there's no need. You can get an, you can be given an idea maybe by it, but also what's the, you know, not knowing what the result was going to be is the, yeah, is the cornerstone of all the, yeah, consumer, yeah, experience in sport. So knowing that someone's, yeah, football score you can see,
yeah,
but equally, you know, having a prediction of all this, like the, in cricket as well, you like got win viz, which is like the, right, the prediction of who's going to win based on all of these things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I used to work for that company, so I'm not going to say too much. But the no, but even just like something as simple, yeah, as that, I don't think is necessary. Just like an evaluation in chess will tell you after the fact,
yeah,
but during, that's the problem. That's why people have this compulsion to cheat, because they want to know what's going on during,
right?
And that's
but commentary must play a huge role in the sport and the scene, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You've got these online, basically it's an e-sport now.
Yeah,
there's a lot of hybrid events where you get people playing across from each other but on separate computer terminals.
Okay,
so it's kind of like you see, yeah, people playing, I don't know what other sports
hybrid
exist.
I guess that, is that considered the hybrid approach, because you're both, yeah, there, you're streaming, but you've got, like, you know, you're still face to face, yeah, and it's not the machine.
That's the hybrid.
And especially when it's like, so it's a technical sport, right? And if I was watching, or if like, if someone who wasn't necessarily familiar with all of the different openings, all of the different moves, comment, you really rely on commentary to just kind of be that bridge, and you see that, and that's kind of what makes great TV. Same when you watch Formula One and they explain all the intricacies of the different rules and regulations. Same even with cricket and football, where they'll sort of talk about matches that happened years ago that were familiar to this. And if you're getting some of these experts like rank one and rank two in the world playing, it's got to be a good thing. But what is there in this scene an opportunity where it's not the rank one and two, and it is just someone with charisma who's excited about the sport, like you have your David Croft and your Ted Kravitz at Formula One who've never raced a car.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. You get, yeah, there's a lot of, I mean, TikTok and Twitch have introduced professional level technicality in terms of the broadcasting.
Yeah.
Where amateurs can do that. I mean, I'm a reasonable chess player, but I feel like I'm able to explain things in the correct way, and there's absolutely no reason why anyone much weaker than me at chess could, you know, be engaging and entertaining and to a point accurate, you know,
yeah,
with how they're, I mean, but that's also, I mean, yeah, saying about the commentary itself, yeah, there's one bloke called Pepe Cuenca, who is a Spanish grandmaster who's probably world number 600 or something. He treats every chess game he commentates on like a horse race.
He's, oh, just, really?
He's just really goes, that's at awesome, it. He's great. And he's one of the most entertaining ones for sure. There's a bloke called Dmitry Komarov, who's a Russian who commentates on the Blitz World Championship, which is getting very fast. And he's just got this beautiful, monotonous Russian voice. And he has even been featured. He's on the Football Weekly theme tune. Going, right, unbelievable, this. That's from a chess commentary.
That's so funny.
So, yeah, there is so much, there are so many people who have made a name for themselves who aren't necessarily at the top of the game, who can just make the sport seem worthwhile to watch. And that's I think that's probably the biggest barrier that people would say with chess.
Yeah,
is that,
yeah,
how can you make it look exciting? How can you make it seem fun? And that's like any sport. You know, there's lots of sports we can think of that are snooker, probably the one,
yeah,
that has just encapsulated generations just by being that little bit quieter.
Yeah, for sure.
But it's still thrilling.
Yeah, yeah. The future of chess. We've seen stuff like chess boxing taking off. We know of stuff like festivals, which incorporate other elements like music. From your point of view, like, what is the best future for chess?
I think that any gimmick like chess boxing can't hurt.
Right.
I don't see, yeah, chess boxing isn't going to become the new norm. incorporating any kind of thing associated with the game can't hurt. You know, like people go and play five-a-side football. I don't think that's particularly what we'd call proper football.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, it's a smaller net, it's not as physical, but it's still one of the most popular, like, casual things around. Having maybe a sort of mini version of chess with, you know, you could easily have a smaller 6x6 if someone wanted to design such a thing, or just having these kind of mini games that, or things associated with it that are still helpful. Because that's the thing, tournament chess and competitive chess and just playing over the board should be the sort of pinnacle of the purity of the game. But there's absolutely no reason why you can't have anything that just helps it along and puts it in a wider context. And again, just, you know, if you're mucking about with it, it's not that you're trying to change it, it's just that you're going, okay, well, we can do this as well. The chess boxing in particular, I mean, I've been to the events. What you generally get is good chess players who are bad boxers, or good boxers who are bad chess
Shall
players.
Shall we quickly explain what chess boxing is?
Yeah, so you basically have, it's the same principle, 12 rounds, 6 of chess, 6 of boxing.
Oh, dope.
And it's the first person to be knocked, first person to be knocked out or checkmated.
Yeah. Brains and brawn.
Whoa.
It's wild.
Occasionally it's brains or brawn.
Yeah. I noticed that when I went as well. It was that I thought everyone was a chess player who had done a little bit of training and they were way too scared to actually like end the game by technical knockout. They were really hoping to get back into the speed chess round. That's awesome. So clearly, like, yeah, the more adaptations, the more interest, the more experimentation is good for the sport. Yeah.
Even with, like, really quickly with adaptations, even at like Twitch live streams or like hashtag chess talk on TikTok, where people like, you know, run through like their like favorite opening move, or like if you're in this, you know, position, move this one here or something like that. Just like little advice pieces. I think it's like really cool, like that this sport, kind of what we're talking about with chess.com, is even though this isn't virtual playing, it's kind of watching someone play online. It's like so adaptable and it makes it way more accessible from the outside, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, anything that is having a running conversation, mm-hmm. is being publicized, is being celebrated.
Yeah.
So there's no reason you can't have, you know, you have an entire YouTube fan accounts for football teams that are just extraordinary resources put behind them. And there's no reason why you can't have the same kind of panel of people discussing a chess game or discussing chess culture. I mean, that's why I've liked doing my podcast, The Chess Bit, because it's basically just that. It's a little little round table.
And it's sick. It's what's great about stuff like Twitch and TikTok, where they are kind of like democratized places where people don't need huge sponsorships and huge backing. They can just film a video and put it online and like hope for the best with it reaching people.
Absolutely.
But sponsorship does help grow these scenes, right? And I think that's maybe a good thing to end on. At the moment, it seems like it's probably more still in like the computing and like the data analytics sort of space. Do you think that more mainstream fashion style sponsorship or the Red Bulls of this world having their hand in chess would also help be a good thing?
Can't hurt, can it? It's just money. money that goes towards better broadcasting, bigger tournaments with the best players getting paid, the best appearance fees, and helping grassroots as well. As long as there's something coming up as well, it's helpful. At the moment, the World Championship and the bigger tournaments are mainly sponsored by, dare I say it, slightly sketchy investment funds.
Sick.
it's just where the money is, and for these big, like the World Championship was sponsored by an investment fund from Kazakhstan. I mean, I'm sure it was fine, but it's also just not very visible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you don't have, you know, as you say, like Red Bull or Heineken or whatever. You know, I think that it's not going to happen for a little while.
Right.
Where you get a really big name. I mean, Specsavers sponsored a lot of junior tournaments in the UK while I was, but that relied on one of the directors having a daughter who played in the England team. Nice. So that's where a lot of, you know, you get a lot of sponsorships that come from it, personal involvement rather than it being necessarily something that the marketing team of a very big company are like, oh, chess. Yeah. That hasn't quite happened yet. And it may well do. I think that's something that, frankly, given the recent boom, should have happened already if it was going to, maybe. Yeah. There will be, all it needs is really just one person to have some energy to really, if they're, you know, if they're a director of Coca-Cola or whatever, to go, right, 5 million.
Yeah, yeah.
Get involved.
People are watching this. There's streamers online. There's like influencers. There's celebrities who are there playing. There's exhibitions. There's like these really interesting personalities. It's a mind sport. There's so much to kind of go off.
But at the end of the day, sponsors are going to want something back. They're going to know, they're going to want to know that the publicity they're going to get is equivalent to their investment. And at the moment, it's not quite there. With there's because also part of that is that because there's been such a boom, there's no particular infrastructure for that. It's just a lot of competing interests from different private initiatives. This is why the World Chess Federation need to get their asses in gear, because they don't really control much of the chess space anymore. It's companies like chess.com or Chess Support or Chess24. There's lots of different, it's a bit fragmented.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you don't have this one big thing that happens that means that a company is going to get a good return on their investment. And that's probably something that would need to change in order for to have like a Champions League style sponsor. Yeah. You could just think about these big events in the world and you know who they're sponsored by. Because they just come up. It's just automatic. You know that when you see the I don't know, it's probably not anymore, but you used to see all the Marlboro billboards along the Formula One races.
Yeah.
Or Heineken sponsored the Champions League. Champions League sponsored by Amstel, Continental. Yeah. You could just reel them off just because they're so ingrained with that particular event.
Mm-hmm.
Not thing in chess.
Yeah, no.
Or
one's
any
really...
minor sport. It's not going to be a thing for a while until there's some kind of corporation or just one big broadcaster that actually puts things towards making it a bit more official and a bit more, frankly, professional.
Mm. Yeah. So this goes out to all the brands that are listening to this right now. You've got a sport.
Get your checkbooks out.
Yeah, you've got a sport looking for sponsorship. Phil, it's been amazing to chat, and I could keep going. Time has absolutely flown by. But first, thank you for joining, Phil.
Thank
it's been
you.
Absolutely
my
lovely.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And stay tuned for
stay
more.
Stay tuned for more, guys. Woo!
Woo! Thank you for listening to The Chess Scene. This podcast was brought to you by Truant London. Our producers are Lucy Austin and Max Ryby Williams. Our technical director is Tom Kemp. Scenes is hosted by myself, Kosti Kontaravdis, and Ruby Carter.